short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Matthew Smith, producer of Vermont Edition, and I wanted to say thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Technology is incredibly important to how so many of us conduct our daily lives. From business we do over email, Slack, and text, to connecting distant grandparents and grandkids via video chat, to having a marketplace of not just goods but ideas right at our fingertips. Spousal and friendly arguments can be adjudicated in minutes by one simple web search. But we also lament the ways that our digital lives seem to crowd out some of our favorite analog activities. And people are working hard to push back against the insidious nature of social media and mobile technology to make sure we preserve time for human connections, handwritten letters, or time outside without checking email. In other ways, we see digital and analog forming complementary bonds, so it's not always an adversarial relationship. Later in the show, for example, we'll learn how Vermonters are using a new archive of old newspapers to discover historical gems that might otherwise be inaccessible. We would like to know how you balance the digital and the analog in your life, and where you are seeing them combine in interesting ways. Andrew in Montpelier wrote to tell us, "I am an amateur musician and play guitar with the Vermont Fiddle Orchestra. Obviously, playing live music is in the analog realm, but I also run a website for traditional music and musicians, the North Atlantic Tune List. It's an endeavor which would be impossible without digital technology. One of the best tools available for learning tunes by ear, as I do, is a piece of digital software called Amazing Slow Downer, which allows me to hear and play along with tunes at slower or faster tempos without changing the pitch, something I was never able to do in the era of analog tape recorders and LPs. Purists can argue at tiresome length about the relative qualities of digital CDs versus analog vinyl recordings, but from an amateur musician's point of view, both technologies have their strengths and together provide a greatly improved learning environment." And I'm joined today by Mary Flanagan, professor of digital humanities at Dartmouth College. She looks at how digital media changes the way we think. And she's also a researcher at Tilt Factor, a design and research studio at Dartmouth, looking at the intersection of gaming and learning. Professor Flanagan, what a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Hi, great to be here, Jane.
So, you know, I sort of mentioned that I don't think the analog and the digital are always in conflict, but they seem to be presented that way so much of the time. How do you see it?
I think you're right in sensing that we tend to think of digital technologies in binaries. So, for example, I left my phone at home, my day is ruined, or I have my phone with me at all times, and I have it on, and perhaps even open in my face. I think that there's a balance that we can strike between analog and digital technologies, but the balance has to come from the way in which we decide to use the technology and the way we decide to use our own time. And I think that conscious decision is something that's just beginning to dawn on a lot of people. We may need to be making relatively soon.
Yeah, when you say it's starting to dawn on many people, are you seeing sort of a rebalancing, this sort of idea that people are realizing how much they're addicted to technology or what an influence it has on their lives, and sort of pulling back and trying to have this better balance between the forces?
I do see it, especially with my friends who work in the game industry and in technology companies. I see a lot of friends going email-free on the weekends. I see a lot of veteran game developers literally calling their day of rest some kind of technology Sabbath, in a way to really make it something beyond just a small choice, but actually part of a larger, perhaps spiritual connotation. So I am seeing that in older generations. I don't know if I'm seeing it really with my college students, for example.
Maybe they're the middle generation, because I see it a lot even in education for younger people. You see forest preschools popping up where the kids are supposed to be outside playing and learning through play, or even secondary education where there's a lot of emphasis now on let's get outside and we'll study science outside in the pond, and then we'll come back to the tablets and we'll be able to identify what we've found and we'll be able to talk about all these things, but really trying to make sure that kids are not just spending all day at a computer or a tablet or looking at a screen.
Well, as we know, it's easy to do.
Yeah.
And I do think that there are really great benefits to be able to have technology bringing information to us at a rapid pace. That said, we also have to think about that idea of not knowing. Remember back before there was the internet at home, we actually either had an encyclopedia to look something up or we didn't have a thing. And sitting with ambiguity, gosh, was that the 1958 World Series? Sitting with ambiguity when you don't know might actually drive a sense of curiosity about those facts. So I think that we maybe give too much credit for the immediacy of information as actually being important information.
For me, as a child, it was something called the Lincoln Library, which was a book that weighed about 700 pounds and had that really thin paper. But yeah, you could find anything in it practically.
Yes, it wasn't Wikipedia, but
but it was something. Yeah, we're getting a lot of examples coming in. One from our managing editor, Sam Gale Rosen, here at Vermont Edition, who says, I recently downloaded the Seek app from iNaturalist, which helps identify species of plants, insects, birds, or anything else that you take a photo of. It's an interesting digital intrusion into the often mostly analog hobby of bird watching. And yet, in some ways, it helps you be more in the analog moment. You can take pics and search with them later instead of flipping through a physical bird book. This may be most helpful for beginners like me, Sam writes. But I love that you can have this digital tool that enhances what you're doing in the analog space and vice versa.
Right. I think that balance is really interesting. And, you know, it would be great if we understood more in the larger sense about that balance, about what digital tools are very, very good for and what, you know, perhaps they need to be let go, where perhaps that happens.
Like social media? What are you thinking of here specifically, Professor Flanagan?
I'm thinking of a lot of things, for example. I mean, we have a large push to bring technology to the classroom. Here in Vermont and New Hampshire, there are iPads and even middle school classrooms. So we have a real push to, you know, have our kids have access and have, you know, wired information. But we see very few studies, actually, on what technology is good for, when it's appropriate, when to hold back. The number of studies in that space are actually quite low. And it's amazing that we don't know more about technology and its use than we do.
If you would like to share your favorite story or an idea or a philosophy, or you just want to engage on this topic, analog versus digital and analog with digital, you can call us 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's talk to Michelle calling in from Montreal. Hi, Michelle. Nice to talk with you.
Hello.
Hi.
Same here. Thank you for Professor, is it Flanagan?
Yes.
I wanted to make it very clear. I'm listening to you from a transistor radio, and the reason I'm mentioning that is I have been, for health reasons, since 2009, I chose to give my robotic device, as I like to call it, the people call it a computer, a personal computer, in 2009 because of health reasons. I had a discussion with my family doctor in Maine at the time, in Portland, in Cumberland County, and that was the best option for myself. Now, each of us is individual, but I can tell you that I concur with the professor regarding the dearth of information regarding research. I have to say, as an amateur at aging, and I have a pension now for over 10 years, it's imperative for me to make people aware who are home. It's a very hot day, and there are people's who health are at home. They don't have anything other than their neighbor at their, who are at least aware that there's a phone they can use in case they need help. I just simply need to make you aware that there's plenty of us, and I would consider myself someone who is growing, smarter every day because I confront the daily occurrences of my responsibilities as a tenant. For example, I meant to pay my rent today, and I had to get outside to do that, as some people are not able to even ambulate about, which is what I have for odors. So,
yeah, Michelle, I appreciate that, and it's an interesting life you're leading, and interesting to hear about how you think about these things and the benefits of having to go outside to go pay your rent, you know, to deliver it to the mail or deliver it to your landlord. And Professor Flanagan, I mean, there are ways and there are people who say, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to just follow what technology is coming my way because there are ways that I feel healthier or things that I'd rather be doing that maybe take a little bit more time. But that's actually what I'd like to do with my time.
Yeah, I hear that, and it's definitely a choice based on one's values. I think that younger generations may have different social pressures and priorities to stay wired and stay connected. Of course, there is that idea of the fear of missing out, FOMO, mm-hmm. where you may miss out on news or opportunities that otherwise would be yours if you just were more online, more accessible, more positive, more available. So there's that kind of operation in effect, but you also just have one's entire social network communicating in a way that you don't want to be left out of. You want to be a part of it as well, and it's fun. It's also built with reward systems. You know, as a game designer, it's very easy to see when little dopamine hits are being given to quote players of even everyday software. Little bubbles and surprises are all part of a gaming mechanism, actually. So our software is actually kind of created with gaming frameworks to keep us hooked.
Mm. So speaking of things that are happening in our brains, you say there's a real dearth of studies, but you have done some studies looking at how we interact with technology and also what kind of differences we see depending on what types of things we're using. So like reading a text online versus reading it on paper, what does your brain actually retain differently?
Well, this is really interesting stuff. Our research all came about because I was very curious. We created a board game and a digital game. It's the exact same game. It's a public health game called POC Save the People. And we did a study based on people's playing of the board game and the digital game. And the results were very different. My observations, a curiosity that led me to the study, was that people played the digital very fast. They played the board game very slow. And those results were confirmed in a study, formal experiment with three different conditions. And we also made a board game version that was zombie themed just to see if a hyper fictionalized environment would actually change motivation or attention span. And looking at the data from that initial study about the analog versus the digital, we were kind of surprised that the least effective in getting people to engage with public health ideas, getting people to really think critically about how they might invest public funds, those were the least strong in the digital version. So, in fact, the digital really didn't promote the level of critical thinking that the board game did. And players often spoke to each other less, they played faster, and they often lost. And this is the exact same sequence between digital and analog. So it's not like the game was at all different. They were identical games with identical sequences of moves. So that was striking my curiosity, and my research team, I was wondering, well, how do we even know what is really effective on an iPad, for example, or a screen versus a piece of paper? And so we ran a study on this idea of construal. Actually, a series of studies on this idea of construal. Now, that's a fancy word for just thinking about the levels at which we're thinking. High construal means more abstract, big picture, pie in the sky types of ideas. And low-level construal is more about like following a recipe, getting your directions, knowing where to go. Obviously, we need both levels of construal, mm-hmm. or we wouldn't be able to function very well in our lives. But we did find some pretty interesting evidence over a series of studies that indicated that, in fact, digital devices fostered the lower level construal work of finding, directing, and getting the details, and the paper interface actually provided space for the higher level thinking, getting the gist of a story, understanding metaphor. So this is really quite compelling when we start to think about what our tools are best used for and when, and also when to even think about not only paper, because when we're writing, we're actually more embodied. But perhaps the study could be extended to thinking about math, to thinking about conceptual concerns, to thinking even about moving physically and learning as a kinetic type of embodied style. So this research points to a lot of curious directions.
So should I just print everything out and read it online and then also read it on paper so that I can get everything and retain every single thing that I've read?
I think it depends what is important to you. Certainly, people can adapt and become very used to and very reliant on their Kindle. But more research really needs to be done. No one's done a longitudinal study of people reading on a Kindle, for example, versus people reading on paper, and how that differs. The number of studies is just really, it's assumed that it's the same or better, right? And that's not necessarily true. It may be more accessible, but it may not necessarily be better. These are things we don't know yet.
Bennett in Middlesex says, as someone who likes to toggle back and forth between four or five different books at a time, I love the fact that I can have multiple books on my phone and can read some parts of one or another book whenever I've got a spare 15 minutes, no matter where I am. I know we think of books as analog, but the digital realm is where books are at their most accessible.
Oh, certainly they're most accessible. My Kindle's got an entire office full of a library on it. That doesn't mean I have the same kind of attention and pleasure. It is pleasurable to read on my Kindle. I'm just not sure the same kinds of points and the same kinds of thinking really comes across. So again, personal preferences are great, and we should follow them. But I also think when we take responsibility, for example, for transforming learning environments, we might need to know more.
And let's bring another voice in here as well. Rebecca Irwin is director and curator of Middlebury College's Special Collections and Archives, and she's in the Middlebury studio with us now. Hi, Rebecca. Nice to talk with you.
It's wonderful to be here.
We were just talking about digital versus analog texts and reading. And I understand you actually have students read Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass in a smartphone, in a printed book, and in an 1855 first edition. So what's actually different about those experiences for students?
So I have done an exercise like this. In part, I think the contribution I can make is to always have our students who, if to put them in context, our youngest students were born around the year 2000. So I never take for granted what they've experienced or what they know in terms of their own uses of technology or texts in whatever format. So what I like to do is to try to have us all be self-reflective and curious. And the example that you mentioned is to choose a well-known poem, for example, Leaves of Grass, and have students pull it up on their phones, but then also to have the 1855 first edition out on a table and have students also look at that. And in the past, I've passed around a Kindle, but I find that 18 and 19-year-olds don't really use Kindles as much as perhaps their parents do. So I haven't used that part of the exercise. And then have a conversation about it and ask, how is the experience different? And what does looking at a book in which the poem was first exposed to an audience for the first time, what might that teach you about the poem and its impact on culture? And what does it feel like to read it in a book that Walt Whitman actually himself printed because he had no money? And each different printing of that book, some of the letters change and there are different typos because he was changing it on the fly as he found his own mistakes. So to bring those up and then to just have that conversation, I find is really meaningful. And sometimes students, actually I would say quite often, students surprise me in their insights of which they prefer. And for example, for myself, I love looking at that first edition, but if I want to find the passage in Leaves of Grass where Walt Whitman refers to a runaway slave, I'll go to Google and find it because it's a lot easier and I don't have the whole poem memorized.
Do you find that students have a preference for how they are looking at things, reading things for schoolwork and for research purposes? I mean, are they accessing the archives and trying to, you know, use the gloves to see the really old texts, or do they want to just see it on Google?
I think we find both. And again, what I try to do is never assume that I understand the students who might come into the archives. It is a space that is kind of unsettling. It's calm and quiet. We don't have technology that's obviously out anywhere on the tables. And students really come with a kind of reverence for the space. I rarely see students take out their cell phones when they're in the reading room where I work. When I have quite rare books out, for example, books that might be 500 or 600 years old, those students really come to that book with a sense of, not just to state it too dramatically, but a kind of sense of awe, where they really do see, I think, the contrast with what is so much a part of their lives. And I do see quite a sense of respect. Certainly, as soon as they pick up their backpacks and leave the door, their cell phones are probably the first thing they pick up, but I might do that too. I think it's important just to know, and I say this again and again, I'm sometimes completely agnostic when it comes to that same kind of preference. And so that is, as you started talking about at the beginning of the show, our technology and our analog world are not really in conflict with one another, but they're always in conversation. So if I can help, especially this generation that was born into these technologies, have that sense of that conversation, it's something of a contribution that I think that I can make. It's the historical side, that is.
Let's bring some more callers in here and talk to Brian, who's calling in from Montreal. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm definitely one of the old literary book generation. I'm 70-ish, and I grew up starting at age 7 reading the dictionary, the full gigantic desk dictionary for the pleasure of it. I'm talking now to professional engineers like I was who are supervising people who are digital only, and that means they're communicating with texts back and forth, making job commitments and job assignments. My friend, who is a really competent engineer and has been doing that profession for 30 years, finds that the employees can't reach decisions on text, on the screen information. They ask for an opinion. My boss asks for an opinion, asks for a commitment. Can you be at such and such a location on Tuesday? And the answer never comes back firm and definite. Is that devaluing of the importance of every single message something that may be a side effect of screens where messages are just so multitudinous?
Brian, that's an interesting question. Professor Flanagan, what do you think? I mean, there is this just fire hose of things that can come at you, and maybe it is hard to sort of differentiate or prioritize.
Yes, that would be a really great study to see about how one values different kind of levels of communication and their volume and their intimacy between someone and their friends or their workplace. I think that kind of commitment or lack of commitment to things on digital has come up in one of my studies where using a digital device was definitely the grounds for not investing, for doing tasks very quickly, for just skipping conversation and kind of passing over. So perhaps there is a grain of truth in the idea that we are experiencing so much so quickly on digital technologies. It's not that important. I'm not sure.
Let's hear from Rachel in Jericho. Hi, Rachel. What are you thinking about?
Hi. Thanks so much for this conversation. I think it's really important. I am 31, and I'm much more on the analog side of things, but I teach kids. I teach middle schoolers. And there was one instance where we were talking, and one of the boys brought up learning how to tie a tie. And one of the other kids said, oh, yeah, you can just look it up on YouTube. And I thought it was so sad and disturbing. And it just made me think that there this generational disconnect is happening because information is being assigned only to the Internet, and that is given this premium beyond something that your parent or your neighbor or people in your community can share with you, and that this perhaps is not realized by people of those generations who really have so much to teach and have experienced the world previous to technology that is this invasive. And I certainly think about that more and more every day, just as someone, you know, who is tangentially involved in kids' life. I don't have any children. But I was just wondering what everybody thinks of that and if there's anything being done to kind of address that or push back against that.
Rachel, that's an interesting example, too. And I'm going to get another one in here first, and then we can come back to Mary Flanagan and Rebecca Irwin. Let's hear from Michael, who's on the line with us from Lincoln. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. I'm just curious if there's been any kind of overarching look at the imprint of digital technology on the human brain. in that we have a whole generation now that's been in front of screens or hearing digital music and the like, and, of course, a huge population being imprinted in that way constantly. And there's we're in such a time of polarity that I'm wondering if that somehow is a cause, or at least at the root of it.
Yeah, interesting questions here, and interesting to pair that with Rachel, this idea that, you know, are we losing connections to humans, and is that then, Michael asks, creating this or contributing to a polarization, or, you know, a lack of civility maybe, or a lack of connection. Both of you work with young people and do research on your own and look at the past and the future and the present. So, Rebecca Irwin, what do you think?
Well, again, I'll answer from the historical point of view. It's sometimes easier than answering as a parent, for example. But historically, I think we all love for the declension narrative. So that is, kids these days, they don't do things like we do, and everything is in decline. Education is failing. And if we look back through time since the classical period, there have been concerns that by reading and not memorizing and reciting things orally, we would lose our ability to learn and to remember. That's Plato, famously, who said that. And for every new technology, really, whether it's comic books more modernly, or there are some wonderful letters that I've read in an archive, not Middlebury's, but elsewhere, where the artist Georgia O'Keeffe sends a telegraph to her husband at the time, another artist named Alfred Stieglitz, and she maligns telephones because telephones will ruin the art of correspondence, and none of us will have any letters to remember our relationships once we all start talking on a telephone. And so, in a way, I don't mean to be sanguine about technology at all, but sometimes it's helpful when I have 18, 19, and 20-year-olds in a room filled with very old things to have them see that there has often been something new, but it rarely replaces the old. So, for example, the electric light bulb didn't replace candles. Candles became more romantic. Or furnaces didn't replace wood stoves, as we know well in Vermont. But they found new audiences and took on different symbolic meanings. So in the same way, our texts in different formats have coexisted for thousands of years, sometimes together. So a scroll on animal skin coexisted with new modern books for 1,000 years, and those old scrolls still exist for certain purposes. And now we scroll on our phones when we read long-form texts. So in some ways, if I can help young people who are so much living in devices to step back and put their use of technology in a longer historical perspective, then perhaps we'll all change our habits a little bit, or at least be more insightful.
Yeah, and there's the eureka moment. Scrolling means scrolling, scrolls, scrolling.
That's right.
Mary Flanagan, what do you think?
Well, I was just in New York, and I took a photograph of an ad that was about copying keys at automated booths, and the advertisement said, "No eye contact necessary," as part of the the benefits of using this machine. And you know, I do think we're going to regret creating a world in which we do not interact with people, and only have programmed AIs around us to tell us what we want to hear. I mean, certainly things won't be as binary, but. There is something to be said about the role in which we are, through our habits and through our technology, shaping culture. And while I don't think any particular technology is inherently evil and is corrupting the youth, I think that through our choices and with our time, we should perhaps reflect on how we think about culture and how we act and live in it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I appreciate both of you being here, not sort of succumbing to the technology bad or analog old. You know, it really is all in combination and in conversation with one another. And I appreciate both of you joining that conversation. Rebecca Irwin is the director and curator of Middlebury College's Special Collections and Archives. Mary Flanagan is a professor of digital humanities at Dartmouth College. She's also a researcher at Tilt Factor, a design and research studio at Dartmouth. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
We're still getting notes about our earlier conversation on analog versus digital and how they combined, and two listeners both sent notes about changes in research methods between when they went for their earlier degrees and their PhDs. Lindum says, for my master's, I was always worried I missed some critical literature, but for my dissertation, I was confident of having everything. And MB says, while access and output has undoubtedly increased, I'm not at all convinced that the quality of education or research has improved, but I can't imagine completing a PhD without the use of digital technologies. Share your thoughts with us or listen back to the program at vpr.net.